CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza.
Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down, they have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and
adult themes.
But, like, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
G'day, everyone. This is B. Javide, a.k.a. The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Super Podcast. And this is, of course, one of our special audio commentary editions of the show. Unfortunately, my regular co-host, Super Marcy, wasn't able to join this episode due to a few things that have come up. So I'll be doing this one on my own. But I won't be alone, though, because I am joined by a very special guest who is coming on the podcast and doing this audio commentary with me. He is a friend of the show, and he has been on the show before, but all the way back when we were doing a In Conversation episode of the Super Podcast. And that, of course, is Anthony Christou, the writer and artist behind Luminous Ages. Hello, Anthony, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Big. Thanks for having me on again, man. It's good to see you guys again.
Yeah, it's not like I haven't seen you in like a few days ago or anything like that.
You know what I mean. Good to be on the show. Different thing versus, you know, because I've never, you know, Bede versus the Terrible Aussie is a different person, you know. So Terrible Aussie is another. So yeah, I get to
exactly
see the terrible side of you. No, just joking.
That's all right. Exactly. But so you're on the show tonight, Anthony. So at the moment, I know you've been busy with a lot of things lately. But for all of our audience who are not aware of your works, tell the audience of the Super Podcast what you do, and also your comic book series Luminous Ages. And also, I know that you've also got a Kickstarter out at the moment as well. Did you want to? So feel free to talk about all that.
Yeah. Cool. I won't hassle people too much, but I'm a fantasy artist, primarily a fantasy artist, fine artist. I've done a lot of paintings. My work is housed in the Japanese Living Art Museum. So I'm not a dead artist in a museum. I'm a living artist in a museum. So that's in Tokyo. So a couple of paintings are in Tokyo, which is really cool. My passion is fantasy art. I do write my own series. It's called Luminous Ages. It's mainly in the form of comics, but there is one illustrated novel. I've released a few art books, which have been really well-funded books on Kickstarter. I'm also, over COVID, like we all learned a new skill. I learned 3D. Well, I did have skills in 3D modeling because that's what I trained in as an artist when I was at university. But I also studied 3D modeling again over COVID towards the end of it and sculpted my own dice, which are balanced. There's dragons inside them. There's goblins inside them. There's wolves on them. I've got about 4 different designs. In total, there's about 4. I'm on my 4th book, but we've released 3 books on using the Kickstarter platform, which has been amazing for my independent books. The Luminous Ages series is a fantasy series. It's, like I said, mainly comics. And the series has 13 dragon gods. Each dragon god has an artifact connected to it. And also, they not only are they dragon gods, out of the 13 gods, about 4 of them are like mage gods and beast gods and all that sort of stuff. The whole idea is whoever can gain 7 of the gods on their side can control dreams and reality. What is really unique about this series is there's 3 types of schools of magic. There's the luminaries, the captivaries, and the chosen. And the captivaries are kind of like artists. It is an analogy for my life in a way, but they have most wizards are born with these dream markings on their body, like ink that changes form and shape, and they can draw and capture their enemies on a page. And vice versa, the luminary can draw and bring someone to life, or tap on a page and bring someone out of a book and bring him to life. So imagine a whole universe on that scale where captivaries and luminaries are fighting against each other all together, and they're creating things or capturing things on a grand scale, like whole entire cities or megalithic statues and all that sort of cool stuff. So it's very high fantasy. The next book, the fourth book I'm working on now, is about goblins. And we talk about the origins of goblins in ancient Greece, because most people don't actually know goblins come from ancient Greece. And what's quite funny is we're watching The Labyrinth today, and there's goblins in this labyrinth. And I sometimes wonder, I'm like thinking, did Jim Henson know about Greek mythology? I look into it and I think, because he's got like a minotaur looking creature, that big, a big furry monster we all know in the movie. And then he's got goblins and they're in a labyrinth. David Bowie himself is dancing like Dionysus, right? Dionysus was the party god, the wine god. And so in Greek mythology, in my comic, in the next book, we've actually got Dionysus meeting the Greek goblins. And that actually happened in Greek myth. So goblins actually interacted with Dionysus. They could shapeshift into Dionysus. And they encountered Hercules. They had a bit of a rumble with Hercules in the mythology. And Hercules thought they were cute playthings and collected them and handed them over to a queen as a gift, one of the queens of Lydia near Turkey. What I've done in the next book is I've talked about origins of our goblins, how they fit into the whole universe with the dragons. Our goblins are like the mercantile creatures. They control trade, money. There's three classes of goblins. But what I've also done with Greek mythology is I've tied in all the Greek stories together. So let's say you've got, in the Greek stories of goblins, there's a little bit about them befriending Dionysus and loving Dionysus and shapeshifting. Then you've got a story of like their fault Hercules. Then you've got a story that they were given to the Queen of Lydia. And so, but in actual Greek mythology, it hasn't been pieced together properly, whether the story's been lost over time or people haven't tied it all in together. And I've actually managed to tie it all together, doing honor and justice to Greek mythos, but now going, all right, adding something creative into it. So I've basically got like the god Hermes as well, who is the god of dice itself. He's actually the god of dice. And the goblins are basically tasked with, by Dionysus and Hermes, who were very close brothers, to go and steal this magical artifact off of Hercules. And Hercules has the artifact of Scylla, which controls a big sea dragon goddess. And that's the next god in our comic, the sea dragon goddess Scylla. Now, our universe is quite big, so all of this information has probably gone over your head. But Bede's like, what the hell? Goblins and dragons and dice and what? You know, it's a lot for people to take in. We are on Kickstarter at the moment. It's called Gorbaloi Goblin Origins. We're about $8,000 in from the 11,000 goals. So we're getting close to being funded. We've still got about 8 days, so we've got quite a while in it. And it's likely to fund. If it doesn't, we're going to go to a publisher to publish it. So, you know, it'll take longer to come out. But that's why I like to do Kickstarters. You don't have to go to a publisher. You can just do it all yourself. So I'm not going to give up on the idea. We've released a special goblin dice, a cage goblin. So I'm definitely going to release the goblin if we get enough orders privately from the Kickstarter. So look, I'm positive it'll do well regardless. But this story pieces in about four or five different Greek mythologies together and almost creates like, I suppose, like a new story, but extending the story of ancient Greek mythology. You know what I mean? It actually extends what the Greeks are writing about, you know, because of my research. Any questions? I'll stop talking, Beebe. So any questions?
No, I think it all sounds really good. Like I know of this project for a while now because you and I are friends, so I've known about it for quite a while. And yeah. At least at the time of this recording, there's still 8 days left on your Kickstarter. So I will make sure that the link to the Kickstarter is put into the show notes of this episode. So if anyone is interested in contributing to the Kickstarter. You can definitely do it via that link there. But no, I think it does sound really cool. Like, I think if you're a big fan, anyone who's a big fan of fantasy, and particularly of your work, I think they should definitely get on this for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And like, just to make it give people a kind of, I suppose, an understanding of my reputation, I've funded 20 projects on Kickstarter now. I'm actually counting right now. I think this is my 20th. Let me do a count. 19th. Sorry. So this is my 19th project. And Bede knows as well, you know, that every single Kickstarter I've ever done, every customer gets their order. You know, I'm always about quality and service, and your packages have always arrived, haven't they, Bede? You know, like, isn't that whenever you...
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
oh, of course.
You know, and that's why people do come back, you know, because they know that I'm always, whenever I fund a project, they're going to get it. And even if there's a bit of a delay with, like, we had COVID or whatever it is, life delays, you know, I'm very transparent and make sure my customers know, hey, look, this has happened, or sometimes I deliver earlier, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, guess what? This comic came in quicker, or me and my other artists, we painted like crazy and we just wanted to get this done because we were really passionate about finishing off these comic book pages. So I think collectively we've raised over 7 years, $240,000 on Kickstarter, which is insane, you know, a part-time income. You know, this isn't the only thing I do. I sell at conventions. I do private commissions. I work for big studios. As you know, working on some secret stuff as well at the moment. Can't talk about. But yeah, any support's appreciated. And I really value every single backer. You know, I'm so grateful that the fans have supported me even up until all this time. It's been a great honor to have these people behind my back that just love the work, and I'm just grateful for them. And I always reward my fans with a lot of bonuses, you know, sometimes too much, maybe.
Yeah.
Too generous.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. Now, as I said before, I'll make sure to put the link to your Kickstarter in the show notes of this episode. So if anyone's interested, definitely go there and contribute. So I'm glad you're here on the show tonight, Anthony, because since you're a guest on this episode, since you did already mention it before, since your latest Kickstarter is centered around a book around goblins and as well as goblin dice, it only makes sense that we watch a movie that features goblins in it. And it's a film that you did mention just before, and that of course is the 1986 film Labyrinth, starring David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly, and directed by the one, the only, and legendary Jim Henson.
Yeah, I know. This movie has been like a great influence to me. We do make a little bit of a joke in the first page of the comic. We do a parody on David Bowie. We call him Jareto Monobrowi. And we've got a David Bowie parody with him with a monobrow. Look, I love David Bowie. It's just a joke. But where our goblins are making a joke that he's not their king, and their king was another goblin that ruled them in ancient Greece. So, but like, the Labyrinth is one of my biggest influences. There's three influences as an artist. Labyrinth is one of them. Star Wars is a second. And the third is The Neverending Story. So I'm so glad I watched this with you. I love this movie. I could watch this a million times. So
yeah, definitely. So that's why we're going to be doing an audio commentary for it, for the episode tonight. And for all of our listeners who haven't listened to previous audio commentaries of the Super Podcast before, what you need to do is, if you have a copy of the film Labyrinth, and it's easy to find anywhere, so it's on DVD, Blu-ray, and as well as a bunch of streaming services out there. So we're going to be starting the film from the very start. So when I count down from 5 and then say go, that's when you play the movie, and then our audio commentary will be in sync with the film. But I'm pretty sure, though, even if you're not interested in watching Labyrinth, or if it's a film that you've already seen a whole bunch of times already, I'm pretty sure that the audio commentary itself will still be a fun listen to regardless. So let's get straight to it. And Anthony, are you ready to watch once again Labyrinth?
Yeah, let's do it, man. Always.
All righty, let's do this. I'm counting down in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Now, Ebony, do you remember the first time you saw Labyrinth?
I reckon I was like about 9 years old or something. And yeah, I remember like, I think it was a cinema. I think I went with my family to the cinema to watch it, or my aunties. And I was just like, what was that? That was amazing, you know? So yeah, I think, yeah, it would have been about 9. Now everyone kind of knows how old I am. So,
so. Yes, you are indeed old. I just kid.
You're only as young as the goblin you're touching. Isn't that what they say, you know?
I don't know what type of goblins you're touching, but I'm just going to leave that at that.
Yeah. I didn't want to say anything.
I kid. Yes. I kid. I definitely know what you mean, of course. But I guess for me, I don't know exactly the first time I saw Labyrinth. I know when I was younger, I saw bits and pieces of it. But I don't think I actually watched it fully proper until maybe probably a couple of years ago, or maybe even maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah, I was a bit of a latecomer when it came to Labyrinth. I was more when I was growing up. I was kind of more when it came to fantasy. I was definitely more of a never-ending story kid.
Oh, yeah.
And Star Wars as well, obviously.
Yeah, I love
and also and speaking of like other Jim Henson films, like the Dark Crystal was another one I watched a lot as a kid, and yeah, it's kind of weird that I never got around to watching this one till about, like I said, probably sometime in the next, probably about 10-15 years ago.
Maybe your parents were saving you from the Bowie crutch.
Maybe.
You know, scarring your eyes.
I mean,
from the tights, you know.
Well, that is true. I mean, his bulge in this film is pretty epic, and we will be talking about that a lot this film, because let's just be honest. It's a bit hard not to notice that bulge in this film.
There are some stories behind that. Yeah, let's watch it. Come on, let's go.
Yes. Is it playing? Yes, but oh geez. And I also got to sort of let our audience know that one of the interesting things about this film, besides it being directed by Jim Henson, and I know this was a passion project for him, and I know, you know, outside of doing all the Muppet stuff between this film and The Dark Crystal, they were like big passion projects he wanted to make, and he enlisted Terry Jones, who was a member of Monty Python, to write the script to this movie.
Oh wow, I did not know that. Wow.
Oh yeah, like and if you know, I'm a big Monty Python fan, so I know all about that stuff because I grew up watching all the show and seeing the movies and all that. So it was pretty cool when I found out, like I think a few years ago, that I was like, oh, Terry Jones, of Monty Python fame, wrote this movie.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, it is. And, of course, we've got Jennifer Connelly. And I think people tend to forget, like, Jennifer Connelly, I believe she was only in her teens at the time when she made this film. But, you know, she has been in the industry for, like, since the 80s. And, you know, most people today would, like, know her for a lot of films, but, and most recently she was in Top Gun Maverick.
Hmm, wow. So I didn't even notice that. So there you go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Jennifer Connelly's been in other movies I know she's been in. She's been in, let's see, A Beautiful Mind, which she won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for, and she's also been in The Hulk, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and just a whole ton of films. Like, oh, wow. Yeah, she's pretty much an acting veteran, and yeah, and this was like one of her first big major roles.
Oh wow, that's crazy. By the way, I'm listening, but I'm also reading something, because I remember reading ages ago the David Bowie bulge was purposefully done.
So it was purposely dubbed, was it?
Yeah. They designed that costume that way. So for those of you that don't know, I've worked as a concept designer in games and films. So I know all about character design, environment design, and all that. And they purposely made the bulge very prominent and very big in that costume, those tights. They made that almost like that cod piece in there purposefully, because the whole idea is that this movie isn't just for kids. It's more like an adolescent movie. It's a coming of age movie. It's the audience is 13 to 18 year olds. You know what I mean? Because it's got a bit more of a scarier vibe to it. And that's probably why you didn't watch it. Like, maybe there is like, or why, I mean, I watched it. Maybe my parents were probably didn't care or they were like, well, they probably cared, but they're like, didn't understand, like, you know, that it was for a bit of an older audience. But I think it was about adolescence and, you know, just show, they wanted to show as being sexually, as him being sexually alluring to the main, to the girl, you know what I mean? To make it look like he, you know, he was, you know, I suppose a tease, put a prick tease, so to speak, or it's seducing her, you know what I mean? So, but.
I guess so, but I don't know, because when I was a kid, though, like I said, I watched The Dark Crystal, which I think is probably even more darker
So Brian Froud is the concept designer, and I've got friends that know of, met Brian Froud in America, and he's a lovely concept designer. He did like a lot of the 80s fantasy movies, Brian Froud, and he was the lead artist on this one, concept designer. But this is so funny. This is a quote. You should have seen Brian Froud's drawings. That codpiece just got bigger and bigger. And my dad was like, this is great. That's terrifying to a teenage girl. That's what the movie's about. She's 15. She wants to be treated like an adult. But whoa, that thing's scary. So, yeah. There's a whole article on it, 80s kids. I think it's on a website called 80s Kids, but it's quite funny. So yeah, we play on that in the comic and page as well. On my comic, we do a parody on that, but not too much. But it's quite funny. Goblins in ancient Greeks and even Dionysus himself, they were both very phallic characters.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I really wonder what I would have loved to. I know Jim Henson's passed away. Well, I would have loved to know if he studied Greek mythology, and that was a big. I'm pretty sure he did, because he did that Jim Henson that Greek mythology series, didn't he? That
he did. I'm like, not sure. I don't remember.
There was like I can't remember. There was an old TV show, but it was like short stories and stuff. And I think it was
The storyteller.
Storyteller, yes. So they did The Storyteller, which was normal other mythology, and then he did a whole series on Greek mythology as well. So maybe he did know about it, and that's what he was drawing from. So, but yeah, I've got to maybe meet his son or something one day. Mm.
So, yeah, well, I'm sort of looking on Wikipedia, and this is a quote from Jim Henson about Labyrinth and like what sort of were his influences. It says here, and I quote, "I think that we are trying to do a film that is kind of harkened back to a lot of the classic fantasy films that a young girl goes to. The Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland, and the works of Maurice Sendak. I don't mind comparisons. It's not that we're trying to outdo them. We're simply related. The Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland are so much part of us. This is the fantasy world that she, the Labyrinth heroine, has grown up with. These are the stories that has fascinated her." Which kind of makes sense, because the character of Sarah, played by Jennifer Connelly, she definitely is very much likes to perform. She's in her own world. She loves fantasy. And in a way, like this, like the world in which she's about to go into, the Labyrinth, is very much kind of feels like a representation of all those things that she loves and adores.
Yeah.
And of course she hates her little brother, which she
Are we actually watching the movie now, or is it playing in the background or what? Sorry, I'm like, I can
see something.
I
yeah, we We are watching the movie. I'm screen sharing it.
Yeah, I can't seem to see it. Well, I'm just getting the subtitles.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Sorry.
Okay, that's weird. All right, let me just hold on for a sec.
Yeah, you're all good, man.
Sorry about the technical difficulties, everyone. So it's all sorted out now. So we'll get back to the movie. And for those at home, the timestamp is 10:10. So just go there and we'll restart the film. So I'll do that now in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And we're back.
He's back on.
Let's see. Yes, we are back on. We are back on. So once again, everyone, apologize for the technical difficulties. Clearly where I was streaming from originally, which was Stan, just did not want to play nice with us. So now we're just streaming the movie on Netflix.
Toby, are you all right? Why aren't you crying?
I mean, isn't this every sibling's dream that their annoying baby brother or sister is just taken off in the middle of the night by goblins?
Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe.
Well, maybe. I mean, I know you have a sister, but maybe she probably thought about that with you.
Actually, I've got a funny story to tell about that, but I was like that a little bit with her, a little bit jealous. So she was, she had curly hair, so I accidentally cut it all off, you know. So,
oh, jeez.
Yeah, she now has straight hair because of that, and because we're playing hairdressers, you know, so, but yeah, quite fun.
I don't blame, I actually, you know what, I don't even blame her for that.
Yeah. Well, she wanted to
so play. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go on. I was just saying, we're playing hairdressers.
I was going
to... Yeah, go on.
No, you go ahead.
All right. I was just saying, like, she wanted to play hairdressers. Her hair's gone. You know, I can't comment, you know. It was her fault, I suppose. Mm.
Yeah. Ah, here we go. Here's David Bowie. Looking all suave with that giant puffy hair.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, can't believe he died in 2016, though. So pretty sad.
Yeah, it was very sad. But he left behind a massive legacy.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes, definitely indeed.
Mm. But how was, because you've talked about before how this was one of your favorite films growing up. How was it that with Labyrinth it became like a big inspiration for a lot of your work?
I think it's the world of the Labyrinth, like the actual Labyrinth itself, the creatures. You look at all the different goblins, and that's probably why I'm doing a goblin comic myself. You know, the different character designs and the goblins. You know, I mean, just the storyline was good, but there was even like the characters that help Sarah in the whole thing, you know, the dog that's riding a dog or whatever, the fox that's riding a dog and Ludo and, you know, all these really cool imaginary characters that she makes friends with by the end of it, you know. And like just looking at that scene just then with the magic of the puppetry, you know, puppetry has a different look and feel to CG, and like movies won't be made like this anymore. And this was done so well. The puppetry was done so believably. And even look at that scene there with the labyrinth, you know, it's just beautiful. You know, it's just something that about it, it's just, you know, and then they're transported there and all that sort of stuff. But I think they just did it really well. And I think, I think it's just the whole, when you're like watching this movie, for me anyway, when I'm watching this movie, it feels very much like you're playing a video game, like this big open world. There you go. It's like a big open world. You can go anywhere with this. And it's like, I don't know. It's just, there's just a feeling. There's just an emotion with it, you know, like, sorry about my chair. It's a bit squeaky today. but there's just this feeling and emotion being incredibly, I suppose, open world, you know, like this the vastness of the world and the different areas and, you know, just the different characters. It just feels very lived in. That's it. It's world building, you know what I mean? And that's what worlds are about. And that's what I try to do with my comics, is have this lived in world. There's rules for everything. You know, even Hoggle, you know, this character here that's going for a leak, you know.
Literally. he's like taking a piss in the pool.
Yeah. So, you know, he's got his vulnerabilities in his character. Like, he's a shady character, but then you fall in love with him because he does want to help Sarah out, you know. So these characters that, you know, you fall in love with, really. Like, you might not like them, but then eventually you do like them. And even Bowie as a villain, you kind of are in awe of him, but at the same time you hate him. You're like, what a prick, you know. He's just, you know, he wants to kill a little baby, you know, turn it into a goblin, and he's causing, you know, trauma to this young girl. So, but yeah. But it's definitely a coming of age film, and I think it's got that vibe to it. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, definitely. Although every time I see Hoggle, I just can't help but think, like, he looks like Keith Richards. It kind of creeps me out.
Oh my God, Keith Richards? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he looks like Keith Richards.
Oh,
like,
my God, now. He does too. Yeah. That's just, but with a, like, an enlarged face, you know, like, is the bigger head on a smaller body.
But Keith, oh yeah, definitely.
Keith Richards has not aged well at all, you know.
Well, to be fair, you probably wouldn't age well if you're about 800 years old like Keith Richards.
Poor Keith.
I mean, there's a reason why everyone says, like, every time a famous musician dies, Keith Richards has a quickening because he just steals their essence and lives another 10 years.
Oh my God. I honestly, like, I mean, it's the same for Mick Jagger. He could also look like Mick Jagger. It's a bit of a combination between Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. They're both Rolling Stones. Mm. There's Rolling Stones in this Labyrinth movie. Maybe there's a, you know, subconscious message in that.
Maybe. It's possible. Although what's interesting, though, is before David Bowie was given the role of Jareth, the Goblin King, quite a number of well-known musicians were actually considered for the role, including Mick Jagger and as well as Prince, Michael Jackson, and Sting. And yeah. Actually, I believe from what I remember, Jim Henson was very set on wanting Sting to play the role, but it was actually his kids who convinced him to cast David Bowie instead. Because at this time, David Bowie was getting a massive resurgence because of his Let's Dance album was massive in the mid-80s, so one of the reasons why... Jim Henson's kids were like, oh, you should cast him as Jareth. He would be amazing. And, you know, and also, if you know David Bowie, he is also a very good actor. And he already had quite a number of acting credentials under his belt before he was even cast in this film.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I mean, he was an all-round, like, talented person. I mean, he could act, sing... You know, and he also was an artist. At the end of his life, he was painting. You know what I mean? Mm. So, you know, all round great human being, you know? So, yeah.
And I like how everything in this labyrinth, especially everything we're seeing right now, everything's just glistening. There's like glitter over the walls, the trees, just everything. And that's one of the things I think what makes this film really cool is, like, the production design of it all is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's historically, it's I think, like, in my view, this is my view, and this is probably why artistically I became an artist, was because this inspired me to want to be creative. It sparked my imagination to want to create imaginative stories and worlds and, you know, comics and all that. But the big thing with it is that it is done so well. That's why I wanted to become an artist, because it is done so unbelievably well. Now, what you're seeing is they've got a matte painting in the background, but the matte painting is done so well that it feels like you can tell now, like, where she's there, that's probably the end of the set.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You can definitely tell that. And the matte painting behind makes, like, as a kid, you wouldn't even know that kept on going. And then you have, obviously, this caterpillar character. I love this caterpillar. He goes, hello, hello. I said, hello. I love that guy. He went to come in for a cup of tea, you know.
But it's, I don't know how. Yeah. We're gonna say, no, you go ahead.
I think what I was saying, like, it's the production value, the scenic artist. I'm good friends with a very well-known scenic artist who's worked on Matrix. He's a family friend. And, like, this artwork, this scene, you know, you could just see the detail in the rocks. You know, for someone to create that scene, it's not actual real bricks, or maybe they threw in a few real bricks, but a lot of that is all created by a scenic artist, you know. And a lot of sets still use that. Like, even the new Mortal Kombat film had that in areas where the actors were, you know. But I find a lot of the, like this here, this magical gateway, you know, which you walk through and it's like an invisible doorway. You know, you're going to see as she goes through this, you go, wow. You know what I mean? The way they've done that. You know, I'm sure there's a trick of the camera or they do something, but regardless.
Oh, yeah.
Regardless, it's brilliant. You know what I mean? And, you know, and that's what creates the mystery of fantasy. And this is what fantasy is about. Fantasy is about this sort of stuff. It's about, like, you know, things that make you want to be there. You want to live in this world. You want to be a part of it. And that's what fantasy should do, is take you away. It's escapism. And then even look at that. Look, I mean, it's just amazing. It is a visual masterpiece. And things like movies like this and the original Blade Runner as well. Blade Runner was so underrated, you know, like, people didn't realize how good the production was on Blade Runner. But you look at this and you just go, wow, you know. And I think it's part of it is because the puppetry is done so well, you know, the characters and the puppets are done so well, it feels lived in, you know what I mean? Sorry. And all the costumes, they feel lived. You know, they've obviously got short people, you know, dwarfs or whatever, people that are height challenged. they're wearing the costumes, and that's what creates the believability. And then you're throwing the chicken in, you know what I mean? Like, to make it feel even more realistic, you know? So I think this is what I mean. Like, now films are so focused on visual effects and crap like that, that I think it's losing its charm. And this has its charm, has the charm there. You know what I mean? I mean, if anyone wants, I bet you now, like, if anyone made a live action movie like this with puppetry and on any topic or theme, and, you know, had the budget to do this, oh, we're going into the dance, the dance, magic dance. Here we go. The dance, magic dance, or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's another thing that's also what makes this film kind of fondly remembered, is that David Bowie did the soundtrack for this film, and the songs are very memorable, particularly Magic Dance, which they're performing right now.
That's it. You remind me of the babe with the power of voodoo, you do, remind me of the babe.
And also it kind of helps that David Bowie kind of looks like a massive Muppet himself.
That does help. Yeah, you're right. You know what it is as well? Like, they talk about this in concept design. It's a caricature. The more you caricature things into it, it all blends in better, you know? So the fact that he is a caricature, he blends in with the puppets, doesn't he? You know?
Oh, definitely.
And I love this bit here. You know, that's just real people, but it's done on a grand scale. And it's, you know, but it just, as a kid, you're like, wow, you just don't question how it's done because it's done so well. That little guy moving the tile, just that's what it is. It's the attention to detail, these little characters they throw in, these little side bits, and, you know, like this guy moving the tile again, you know. It's just, that's what creates this whole believability, this is the suspension of disbelief. You're like, oh my god, this just feels so real, you know. But yeah, anyway, still doing the dance magic dance thing. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Although I have to say, though, maybe it's just me, like see the baby Toby in these scenes, you can't help but, like, I can only imagine how mortified that kid is right about now, being around all these puppets.
Do you want a funny story about Toby?
What's that?
So when I was in ElluxCon, I went to a big fantasy art show for original paintings in Pennsylvania and in the US. Mm. I met, like, Iris Compiet, and I met the lady who organizes FairyCon, which is a big fairy show there for, like, fantasy art, but like a medieval fair, but all fairy focused. Mm-hmm. And I'm friends with her. Her name's Amy. And guess who always is a guest there?
I'm going to assume the actor who plays Toby.
Toby. And Brian Froud sometimes rocks up to this event as well. So she's like, she knows him on a first name basis. Like I said, I've got some connections in America and friends there. And yeah, and apparently, you know, they get to hang out with Toby for the weekend. You know, he goes to that fairy con in America and he's always there. And sometimes Brian Froud rocks up if he can make it. And
Well, I think that kind of makes sense. Brian Froud would want to rock up because the actor who plays Toby is Brian Froud's son.
Exactly right. So they probably go together. That's exactly right. So, yeah. And yeah, apparently he was traumatized a little bit, but he's okay now. That is the truth. That actually happened. So he was traumatized, but he's all good now. So,
well, at least that's good, because if it, like, I could just... being in a movie like this would have put me in therapy if I was his age in it.
Oh yeah, I think anyone, most, and especially if people, some people are, kids are more sensitive to, like, monsters and stuff.
Mm.
You know, I love these characters too, and the doorknobs as well. I think the doorknobs are in this scene, but I love. Or is it the next one with the doorknobs?
It might be the next one, I think.
Yeah, but I love these guys. These guys are great as well. The upside down, whatever they are, goblin thingies. It's just, I think it's just this whole universe of characters. And yeah, it just really makes you fall in love with it, you know, I think. So it's a masterpiece. Nothing beats it, you know.
Mm.
For well, the time. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, like, we've kind of have to remember in the 80s, like, the 80s was... probably one of the the decade of the fantasy film, because there were so many different fantasy films that came out of different varieties, because you had ones that were aimed at kids and families, like Labyrinth and Neverending Story or Return to Oz and so many others. And a lot of them did have a dark edge to it, but also you even had ones that were kind of more aimed at older crowds, like Legend or Conan the Barbarian and so many others, like,
and Red Sonja or whatever as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there was a lot like that. Yeah.
Mm. And it's kind of funny that this film, which when it came out back in 86, it flopped at the box office. And I know that like, because I think this budget was, and I'm gonna look this up just so I'm like, this isn't wrong. Let me just find out, just to make sure. See, this scene in particular, I love the use, the hands doing the talking.
Mm.
This is pretty cool and creative.
Yeah, I thought this was good too. I mean, like I said, it's all these amazing ideas, You know, and it just makes it Jim Henson. You know, the way Jim Henson's crafted this and come up with these concepts, you know, it, like I said, it makes it so much more believable because it's not CG, because it's real things, you know, real hands, real people, real puppets, you know, real actors, real sets, with a bit of matte painting in the background. It's just so well done, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, I was sort of looking up before. This movie cost $25 million at the time, cost $25 million to make, but it only made $35 million all up.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, well, I know that at the time when the film was released, it was considered a box office flop, and I think Dark Crystal might have been as well. I'll have to find out, because I do know that when this film flopped, because like I said, it was a passion project for Jim Henson, I do remember that from things I've read in the over the years, that I know that this film not been doing as well as it did definitely really got to him. So let me just find out.
As in it got to him that it flopped, is that?
Yeah, like it really hurt him personally that it didn't do well.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why, and it's you know, and this is even like anyone that's an artist, I mean, being an artist myself, and when things don't go well as you hope with paintings or whatever, you do take it personally. You want people to love what you've created, you know. You don't, I think as artists, you know, you can, as an artist, writer, filmmaker, whatever you are, creative person, you don't want to create in a bubble and never reveal it to the world. You know, a part of creating something, we all want to create something. I mean, we want people to love it. I don't know. Maybe it's there's some, most artists have this childhood trauma where we take something to our mum and our dad, and they don't give us the love and attention on this painting or whatever it is that we create. Or maybe they give us the love and attention, and that's what makes us enjoy the whole creative process, because people are, like, I know I had support as a kid, and my parents were threw money at me to make art, you know, in the sense of they would buy me art materials or take me to art classes, and they were always impressed with what I did. So, you know, I think it's a psychological thing. We all want to be loved, you know, we all want to be respected, we all want to be appreciated, and you know, that's part of being an artist and being creative, a creative soul. And I feel sorry for Jim Henson. Like, at the end of the day, I loved his work, and I still love his work. And even the Henson Company, his son is still keeping it alive. And the work is brilliant, you know. And this is the thing, like, people take this stuff for granted, and it's becoming more so, like, creating visual effects and movies, CG. Now, I think all the new Marvel movies are brilliant, like, even up to Infinity War, like, you know, Endgame and all that. People go, oh, no, it's all being done, or, you know, or they're over it, or they're over all these superhero movies. But people don't understand the artistry that goes behind it. And I think we're just living in this, our society's kind of slowly not appreciating it more and more. You know what I mean? And what it takes to make a movie, what it takes to do visual effects. I mean, that I love that door that Hoggle goes through now, what he did there in this scene here. I love the stone walls talking. Don't go this way, you know. Was it because it was too scary that it flopped? Kids were like,
I don't know. Like, it's kind of a weird thing, because I was sort of looking up before Dark Crystal, which came out in 82. That also cost about $25 million to make, but that only made $41 million at the box office. So I think it's because both this film and Dark Crystal flopping kind of really turned Jim Henson off from directing. Because it's not to say that he didn't direct films that were hits, because I know he directed quite a number of the actual Muppet films. Like, let me just find that one. Entries he directed. Like, he directed The Great Muppet Caper. Yeah, well, actually, that was the only one he did direct, but yeah, I think after Labyrinth, like, he just didn't want it. Like, both this and Dark Crystal flopping, I guess he just wasn't interested. It kind of deterred him from directing another film.
Mm.
Which is a shame, because I think as a filmmaker, whether it is these films, and recently, like a few, like a couple of weeks ago, another streaming service here that's out there called Movie had quite a number of his early short film works on there, like back from in the 60s and 70s. And I watched quite a number of them. And they were just really, really good and really inventive and creative. And it showed that he had an interesting eye as a filmmaker. And, you know, of course, most people would know for his work as the Muppets, because that is what made him a huge star. But I think as a filmmaker, he wanted to try different things. And with The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, they were, you know, had the puppetry that he was most well known for. But he wanted to tell these kind of really darker fantasy stories. And I guess for audiences, they, I don't know, maybe they just weren't marketed well, or maybe at the time, because there were so many fantasy films that came out in the 80s, maybe people were kind of similar to how some people are with superhero films at the moment. Maybe some people are just burnt out by fantasy films because there were so many. Or maybe there was a lot of competition at the box office when it came out. So, yeah, I guess there could be a lot of different factors at why that is. But it's kind of a shame that it kind of deterred him from not wanting to direct another feature film. It's not to say he didn't work on other films after this. I know he was like a producer on a few things, like The Witches and a few others as well. But I guess, like, as you said, like, he just, yeah, I guess he really kind of took the
Which movie? You know, he died in 1990.
Yeah, I know that, but he was a producer on The Witches, which came out in 1990.
The Witches, which one? Oh, The Witches. Ah, yes. Ah, The Witches. Yeah. Sorry. I thought you meant The Witcher.
I don't think he was around. I'm pretty sure that's all what I was referring to.
Sorry.
But, you know, I know, like, The Witches and the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles films were like one of the last few projects he worked on before he passed away.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? I actually met Kevin Eastman, and we're talking about this stuff because he worked with the Jim Henson Company to make the Ninja Turtles movie. So it was a partnership with Jim Henson's company, and to make those costumes and make it feel lifelike. And I was talking to Kevin Eastman, and he reckons like he, because obviously because I'm, you know, I've been a guest at Supernova and Comic-Con and talked at all these shows and stuff, and I'm lucky enough to sit next to people like this. And I was talking to Kevin Eastman about the Ninja Turtles. He's, as those that don't know, he created the Ninja Turtles, writer, artist on that, the main guy on that. And I was saying, oh, what do you prefer? Do you like the old 90s Ninja Turtles movies or 80, whatever, whenever they were, late 80s? Or do you like the modern, you know, CG stuff that Michael Bay's done? He was not happy. And like, what have I said? Have I upset you? He's like, I don't want to talk about it. He goes, he basically turned around and said, I love the old costumes. And, you know, he doesn't like the CG stuff. Apparently they were planning the Ninja Turtle movies. They were planning on using the Henson estate and his son to remake the Ninja Turtle costumes and modernizing it a bit. And they were going to use visual effects and stuff, but they're going to use, like, most of it was going to be with practical effects and then do CG for the really hard bits. And it all got shelved, and Michael Bay took it all over, and Michael Bay made it all CG. And let's just say him and Michael Bay have a love-hate relationship. It's not, you know, I don't know, I don't want to go into the politics of it all, but apparently, yeah, he's not happy with that, the CG stuff, you know. And Michael Bay even wanted to take the Ninja Turtles in a different direction. And this is the thing, when you get the wrong producer on something, it can actually screw it up completely. you know, and so this is maybe why we haven't seen any new Ninja Turtle movies. Have you seen any new Ninja Turtle movies?
Well, there's a new one coming out in a few months.
Oh, there you go.
And I believe it's going to be a fully animated one. It's, I believe Seth Rogen's producing it.
Oh, 2D animation?
No, it's 3D animation.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like a computer generated. It's kind of going to be done in the same, similar style as Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, yeah, cool. So it's 3D, but it's made to look 2D.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. See, that could work. That could probably be way better. And that, I think that's probably the direction that Kevin Eastman wants to go in. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And because people, and this even goes into AI stuff as well, AI art. You know, like I think people want to know that it's made by humans or has a more of an expressive look versus something that's just CG or AI generated. It's so funny. A friend of mine he's a producer, but he's into the AI stuff, just playing around with it. And he showed me this one AI, a series of artworks or images. I won't call them artworks, a series of images. And it's, you can Google, probably Google it. A series of images that are AI art or AI images that are the labyrinth, but in an alternate universe. The set of the labyrinth movie, but in an alternate timeline. And it's really kooky and weird. It looks really spooky. Like the actor looks like David Bowie, but it's not David Bowie. You know, Sarah, the girl, looks like her, but it's not, you know. There's Jim Henson there, but it's not. It's really freaky, and the puppets and the goblins look almost like a horror movie. It's really dark. It looks, it's still got the same vibe, but it's very dark and weird. You know, I love that scene with that guy, that guy on the night. But anyway, it's quite funny. It's worth Googling and looking at because it's very creepy looking. I'll send you the link later, Bede, so you can have a look.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, go on, what were you saying?
Oh, nothing really. I was just going to say, like, yeah, because now we're in the scene where she's in the hedge maze and we're kind of being introduced to all the other characters. Like you say, we're introduced to the Nye character and this giant creature thing whose name I keep forgetting. That's the thing. This is how, like, I haven't seen the movie as much as, say, you or other people, because I think Hoggle, Jareth, and Sarah are the only characters' names I know in this movie. But you're right, though. I think, you know, with the puppetry and the special effects in this film, I mean, that is the magic of the Henson Company right there. Like, the fact that they can make these puppets. Like, yes, they're obviously puppets.
But they feel so alive.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's funny, though, when you kind of watch people, like, especially behind-the-scenes stuff of whether it be on the Muppet movies or Sesame Street, like, and you have the actors there. And even, like, some of the actors, like, you know, if a well-known, famous person is, you know, acting across a Muppet, like, a lot of actors who I've read, like, they forget that it's an actual puppet, like there's someone there underneath, say a table or something, controlling the puppet. Those characters feel so alive that it almost feels like, oh, that's an actual real creature that they're talking to.
Yeah, it's crazy,
isn't it? And or even like in this scene, what is this character's name? You know it much more than I do.
Ludo.
Ludo, yes, Ludo. Like, it's obviously a guy in a suit, like a big, massive suit, and with an animatronic head.
Yeah,
but he looks and feels so believable.
Of course. And that's what you don't get with CG. You just don't get this belief. You know that it's CG, whereas this, you kind of, that's like, I'll be honest with you, man. I'll be completely honest with you. If the Jim Henson Company created a completely original puppet movie feature film like this, And it was something very popular, like a theme that, like, even Alice in Wonderland, or they did something like something that was, they picked a comic book series that was like virally popular. Like, it, you know, let's say my comics went viral and I had all the money in the world, I'd hire the Jim Henson Company to turn Luminous Ages into, you know, a puppet version of what I've done, like, in, like, with his realistic puppets, because it would still fit my thing, you know. Apart from the big dragons coming to life and breathing fire, but I think it would, like, I think it would make, like, millions, hundreds of millions. Like, it would have to be a masterfully created piece of art like this, but I think it would be viral, because I think it's something that we've lost, and it's something that needs to be revived and found again, you know. Like, not found again, but really, you could really master it with combining CG as well. You know what I mean? It'd be a huge budget. But this is the thing, and this is the thing, like, as I was saying, I am working with a producer on my series, and nothing serious yet. We're just talking. I'm just talking to a producer. Have been for about the last year. But the big thing with turning anything like a comic or any story into something like this, like a movie. I love these doorknob guys. They're the best. they're my favorite. I want to get one of them on the front of my studio. Like, I want to get a sculpture, pay for one, and have it on my doorknob on the front of my house. Or I think on the studio makes more sense, because, like, you know, make me feel like I'm entering another world every day.
Well, that's the thing. I bet if anybody, if you went online, you'd be able to find these, like, replicas of these talking doorknobs.
Yeah, for sure. But as I was saying, like, ultimately, the thing with making something really artistic like this, like movies like this, is Hollywood, like, talking with producers now, I've talked to a few, and I know, like I said, I've got some friends, I should say family, that have made it big in Hollywood, and you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking, I can't say names, drop names on here, but the reality is, they want, what Hollywood wants is proof it's going to work, you know, before it actually works. And so taking risks with Hollywood, like what Jim Henson's done, because of all the, even though things are so well done, like this movie, studios don't want to take risks anymore, especially with COVID, with the economy, everything. And unfortunately, fantasy is one of those genres where they don't want to take that risk, or you really have to have something that's so well done, like the Harry Potter books. Books were so viral and popular that making the movies was a no-brainer, you know. And that's unfortunate. That's the unfortunate reality of the entertainment industry and being a writer and artist and trying to get something being picked up is actually really, really hard. And the thing is, you could get picked up, you could make a movie, or you could do an animation, or you could do a comic and it becomes an animation, you get the funding and it happens, but it could also, like this, not take off and go, you know, it could still make a profit, but not be viral and be as big as, and this is why things like Star Wars have done so well, because it went viral. Things like Lord of the Rings, things like, again, Harry Potter, it got lucky. You know, the story was great. I'm not saying Labyrinth isn't a great story, but it also got lucky that it was coming at a time when, you know, not many movies like that were being made. You know what I mean? So I'm hoping for a big fantasy resurgence, but I'm, like, talking to a lot of producers, I'm actually seeing the opposite. Like, I think they're too scared to do fantasy because of the, you know, with the new Rings of Power series flopping. Did you notice those rocks look like Bowie himself? Like, it's
the, yeah, I was going to say, like, pretty much like, like how it's sort of put. It looks like a very cool optical effect, the way how they sort of, the rocks, if you look at them at a certain angle, looks like David Bowie's face.
Yeah. But as I was saying, right now, like, the reality is getting something like this made again is very hard, you know what I mean? And there's huge risks, you know, because you can make it and Maybe audiences don't appreciate it again. You know, they're like, or maybe they do, you know, or, you know, maybe they release the movie just when the economy is falling apart, or the film industry is really, really crazy like that. Like, you know, as you probably know, but I know all we can do is appreciate classic movies like these.
So, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I remember I watched this with my nephew or niece, and they just said, oh, this is like a really old movie, Uncle Anthony. It made me feel really old. I go, yeah, I know it's an old movie, but, you know, people don't always look at things from an artistic point of view. People just look at things in terms of story only.
Yeah.
And does it grab their attention? You know, that's the other thing as well. So that's the sad truth of it. But, yeah. I won't give you any more sad facts. We can change the topic to happy topics if you like.
Let's talk about David Bowie's Cog piece again.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Because it's very prominent in this scene with Jareth and Holly.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said before, man, it was purposely done. It's like an adolescent coming-of-age movie, you know?
I swear it gets bigger and bigger as the movie goes on.
Oh, my God.
And it just occurred to me, the birds, I think those are actually puppets as well. I thought they were real birds for a second. Oh my God. Well, I was sort of also looking up because I was going to see, because the film, oh, geez, these things are terrifying.
Oh, they are, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think this scene looks the weirdest, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this was probably the worst. No, I mean, it's a good, like, storyline. It's cool. But I think, like, the way that the puppets, I think they use, like, a CG background, or they, like...
Well, it would have been a green screen. And yeah, then they could composite it into the back obvious. To the scene. Yeah.
It's quite obvious, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't just sort of look right with how where this scene in the swamp is, like the lighting and everything. It does look like it's shot in two different places and just thrown together.
Yeah, for sure.
But these guys are like freaking me out, man.
Yeah, I know they are. Their bodies are falling apart.
There's like way too many creepy puppets in this movie.
And that could be why it didn't do well. Maybe kids were scared, like there were parts that like kids would cry, or, you know, and they'd have to take kids out the cinema or something, you know.
It would not surprise me at all, to be honest. I probably would have been shitting myself, to be honest. But then again, I watched a lot of weird stuff as a kid. Like I said, I saw The Witches as a kid. I saw Return to Oz as a kid. And those movies are fucking horrifying, man.
Yeah. It is scary.
Yeah. So I'm just going to assume, like...
You know what was scary? Like, even The NeverEnding Story was scary and sad. Like, so when they first released NeverEnding Story, you got the Gamork or whatever it is, the evil wolf guy. And the first cut, when it was first released in the cinemas, the eyes were red. And that freaked the crap out of kids. Like, kids were crying, running out of the cinemas. And they had to then go back and fix that up and make it green eyes. I don't know if they fixed it up in the cinema, but the later versions, the version that you're going to see is with the green eye Gamork. You know, so it wasn't so scary. And that whole Swamp of Sadness scene as well with the
horse. Oh, jeez.
I was traumatized, man. I even saw that as an adult and I was freaking crying. When I saw it later in life and I hadn't seen the NeverEnding Story for years, I'm like, man, this is like so sad. Like, don't watch the Swamp of Sadness scene or watch the NeverEnding Story hoping to cheer you up when a family member's died. It's the worst fucking movie you can watch.
Oh, yeah.
Go watch Dumb and Dumber instead. If anyone close to you passes away, knock on wood, Go watch Dumb and Dumber. Don't watch like the Neverending Story. It will make you cry. You know.
Exactly. Well, I read somewhere that it's funny you mentioned the eye thing when it came to Gabork. Is it? I keep forgetting the character's name.
Gabork.
I think I read a study somewhere like a while back that I think the color red actually does it when eyes are colored red in a movie, it does scare people on a subconscious level for some reason.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think I read, and especially with kids, and so it doesn't surprise me at all that, you know, after when the Neverending Story came out, they would have gone back and like in post to change the eyes to green.
Yeah.
Because it would have been, because just for that reason alone.
Hmm.
And yeah, Gabork used to scare the shit. Actually, you know what? It wasn't just Gabork who scared the shit out of me in that film. It was the giant turtle creature.
Oh, yeah.
He was terrifying, even though he was nice.
I wasn't scared of him. No, I wasn't scared of him.
I think it was because...
Yeah, go on.
I was going to say, like, I think it was because he looked huge. He was a huge puppet with the actor who played Atreyu in that film.
Yeah, for sure.
So it was pretty terrifying. Although, that being said, though, for a movie with having some darker elements in it, it's not a movie that's afraid to get very silly as well with this swamp that just, like, just basically, the like... Swamp.
Yeah, I love
the farting swamp. Yeah.
Oh, my God. It makes me laugh, man. Every time I see it, you know.
How many times do you reckon you've seen this movie, Anthony?
I think at least 30 times in my lifetime.
Nice.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, this is one movie that I'm not scared of, so I would watch this to cheer me up, definitely.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
No, this, I don't think this movie is as scary as The Neverending Story.
Oh, definitely not, no. I mean, there's definitely some images, or at least some puppets,
yeah,
that look terrifying. But at least in terms of the terrifying scale, yeah, I think The Neverending Story is definitely a bit more frightening than this one. Actually, I would even say Dark Crystal is probably more scarier than this movie.
Yeah.
Or even Return to Oz, which was one that I used to watch a lot growing up. Yeah,
I've seen that a couple of times, so I can't remember. I'm more of a Wizard of Oz fan, the original Wizard of Oz. So.
Oh, I love the Wizard of Oz as well, but Return to Oz is pretty damn good.
Yeah, Michael Jackson was in that, wasn't he?
No, that was...
another one, aren't I?
The Wiz.
The Wiz, yes.
Yeah, that had us also has got Diana Ross as playing Dorothy in that version.
Oh, wow. Return to Oz.
Yeah, it's on Disney Plus.
I might have to check it out.
Yeah, definitely give it a check out, because it's really good. And also, the Wheelers in that film are going to haunt your dreams.
Oh, my God. Return to Oz. Okay, I have to see it now.
Yes, you'll have to.
Uh-oh.
I love this little guy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The fox guy with his dog that he rides, that he mounts.
Yes.
Yeah. It's definitely pretty good.
Especially when he does ride that, the fox.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen Return to Oz. Well, maybe I did and I just, like, can't remember.
You probably blocked it out of your memory because it was that scary.
Probably because it was such a crappy version of it. You know, the CG was that bad. You know, she does look familiar, yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah, no, I think I have seen it. That's crazy, yeah. And I have seen it, but it's just in the back of my mind because I remember this actress. So maybe I got to go back and watch it. Is it good quality in Disney Plus? Is it like
high? Oh, totally. Oh, totally.
Ah, have to see it.
If I say so, then it must be true.
I have to believe you.
Yes. That's what's true.
I have to believe you.
Yes.
So is the premise that the return to Oz is like totally screwed up or something, or?
Essentially, yeah. Basically, that whole movie starts off with Dorothy. Like, it is a sequel to The Wizard of Oz, or at least the story. And the whole plot, at least the first half, is that Dorothy is what keeps telling everybody of the things that happened in Oz, and her auntie and uncle are so feel like that she needs to go see a doctor about this, and then she gets sent off to a psych ward. And it has to be, it's pretty dark, and there's a scene where she gets basically almost gets shock treatment.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that movie is dark, man. Okay, maybe not dark, but it's still pretty dark for a kid's movie.
Oh wow. That's funny.
And the bridge falls apart.
Oh, crap.
See, this is why I don't, like, try to cross any bridges that are small enough to fall apart.
You don't touch that ever. No.
Yes. Oh, yeah, by the way, like, speaking of Hoggle, since he just showed up in this movie, like, a couple years back, I think I saw on Twitter, somebody was, like, going through kind of some storage and that, and they found, this was, like, a few years ago, and they found the original Hoggle puppet.
Oh, no.
And let's just say, if you look up the Hoggle puppet online today, it looks terrifying because the puppet has deteriorated since film. It looks terrifying.
Oh, no. Maybe we should make a new version, like a horror version of the Labyrinth.
Are you saying that this is not already a horror version?
This movie here, I'm saying we use that puppet to make a horror movie, you know?
Well, that is true. All right, I'm going to have to find this.
I'm Googling it now. No, I can't find it. Do you have to find me something?
Yeah, I'll have a look for it.
Oh, no, yeah, I can see it. It looks pretty crap, man. It looks like he's been punched in the face quite a lot.
Yeah, it's literally the puppet is falling apart. It does look like it belongs in a horror movie.
There's someone else that's showing it as Keith Richards as well. Oh yeah, it's definitely lost its magic. Oh wow, yeah, it looks like it's you know what it looks like? You know those native tribes where they like they get like humans and they turn them into puppets almost like they.
Oh, shrunken heads.
Yeah, it looks like that almost, the shrunken heads, whatever they are. Yeah. Poor Hoggle.
It kind of does.
Yeah, it does.
But oh,
yeah.
there's another Jareth head back there.
Yeah, it used to be good, man. It actually looked alive. Now it looks like a bad puppet, a really bad worn away puppet. Oh my God, exactly. There's one that's rotting away. There's one that's someone found Hoggle from Labyrinth rotting away. Oh my God. That is scary. Poor Hoggle. They got another version of him as well in glass.
Yeah. Yeah, they would have had to have made like a couple of different versions of each puppet for the film.
Yeah, it's scary.
Well, I was sort of looking up because the cinematographer on this film, Alex Thompson, it's not the only fantasy film he made during the 80s because he was also shot Legend and Excalibur.
Oh, yeah. Excalibur was good.
Mm. I haven't seen Excalibur for a very long time. That's what I need to revisit.
Yeah, it's a classic. And even Legend is pretty good too.
You know what's funny though? I hated Legend the first time I saw it, but this was like maybe 15, 16 or so years ago since I last saw it. So that one I definitely is what I need to revisit for sure to see how I feel about it. Although I will say, Tim Curry looked pretty cool in that movie.
He did. Am I right to just quickly take a toilet break and come back?
Yeah, sure.
I won't be long.
Okay. I guess while Anthony's gone, I will entertain the rest of the audience in this movie.
Hello, everyone. It's me, Louise Latham. First of all, oh, wait a second. This is a... The Doobie Tuesdays podcast.
Louise, what have I told you before about coming on this show?
Yeah, but, you know, I thought I was on the normal Doobie Tuesdays podcast. And this is weird because this is the first time, Pete, that you and I are talking together.
Yeah, I know. It's weird because every time you show up, I just start getting a little terrified and go into shock.
Well, first of all, Craven does the same as well. But that's only due to how beautiful I am. And, you know, I can't blame him because I'm such a gorgeous woman and he's such a hunky man. And if I was Craven and I was in my presence, I too would go into shock due to how beautiful I am.
Well, I mean, that is true, Louise. So I can't blame you for that.
So anyway, so what movie are you actually watching?
Well, this is a film called Labyrinth.
Oh, I know of that movie. It's such a wonderful movie. There's so many great puppets. And this Ludo guy kind of looks like, is almost as hairy as Craven. Ah, oh, I do love my big hairy men.
Sorry about that, Louise. I just had to do a slight cough. Sorry.
And also, it's a bit weird that you're doing this podcast on your own.
Oh, well, technically, Louise, I'm actually doing the show with my friend Anthony. He's just duck out for a second.
Ah, oh, that makes a lot of sense, honey.
You know, it's weird, Louise, because usually this type of thing would happen. Weird things would happen during the Tubi Tuesdays podcast.
Oh, I know, honey. But, you know, at the same time, though, I gotta be here because David Bowie's in this movie. And, oh my gosh, I need that hair. That looks like the type of hair I would wear in Blood Rage. Actually, I need to have my hair like that. He looks fabulous. And I can't blame Jennifer Connelly. I mean, David Bowie was a very hunky man. Not as hunky as Craven, but still quite hunky.
Well, I mean, it's David Bowie. So, you know, I can't really blame that, Louise.
Yes. And also, all these people in costume, I'm a little creeped out right about now. So I may have to get going now. So, you know what? I got a lot of red wine to drink anyway. So that's probably why I'm freaking out. So I'll see you later, B. Bye. And I'll...
Oh, bye, Louise. Well, Louise has popped up on the show, but I was not expecting that.
I could hear someone talking from a distance as I'm walking back from the toilet, so yeah.
Well, you arrived just in time because, oh wait, I actually paused the movie. Sorry about that, people. So we're back at the movie, and let's just say it got weird during the middle of the show, Anthony, and that's all you need to know.
I'll blame you, mate.
Don't worry. If Marcy was here, she'd be blaming me as well. But anyways, though, we have another song from David Bowie. And mind you, this isn't actually the Labyrinth set. This is just David Bowie in his normal life during this scene.
Really?
Well, that was a joke, but that's beside the point.
trying to pull me on all my legs.
Yes. Although I have to think, though, because like I said before, like both, you know, you had Mick Jagger, Sting, Michael Jackson, Prince, and a few others being in talks for this film. Like, I can only imagine what the soundtrack to this film would have been like if any of those guys, like, started it and did the soundtrack as well. It probably would have been pretty amazing.
I think Bowie has a certain vibe to this.
Yeah. I can agree with that.
What's the funny thing with fantasy, unfortunately, as much as I've tried to fight against it, fantasy has connotations to medieval, and medieval has connotations to England. So having an English singer, pronounced and all this sort of stuff, people always associate fantasy with white people, unfortunately, and England, and that's probably why it was so successful. So if it had an American singer like Michael Jackson, maybe not so popular, you know what I mean? Because it would have lost its fantasy edge. I don't know. I don't know, man.
That's a big, Michael Jackson was huge in this period too. This was like the Thriller Bad period of Michael Jackson. So maybe if he starred in the film, it probably would have gotten even more people probably would have rocked up. But then again, who really knows at the end of the day?
No one knows.
Yeah. And as we've seen before, even though there's a lot of special effects in this movie that hold up pretty well, there's definitely some special effects that definitely don't hold up. But I kind of think that's kind of the charm of the film. Oh, this old lady looks like me when every morning I wake up.
Oh my god. I think I got scared of this puppet. I think this puppet scared me as a kid as well.
You know what's funny though? She kind of looks similar to that other puppet, to a very similar puppet or Muppet, in The Dark Crystal. There's one that kind of looks similar.
Yeah.
I can't think of that character's name, but she kind of looks similar.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
And I like that she has a southern accent. Well, you see here.
I'll take
you down the labyrinth. Oh, the movie's over. I can go back to my life as being a teenager.
Will she forget?
I mean, my life would be a lot better if I didn't have a baby brother.
Oh my god.
I get the parents all to myself. I get all the money spent on me. And I get to sleep at night without any babies waking me up. And that teddy bear looks like the same one from Play School. I think all that stuff that she's holding on her back must be broken carrying all that.
Oh my god. I think she's definitely got osteoporosis.
It's either that or she's like an ant. She can fit like a ton of stuff on her back and it's like no bother to it at all. And I like that if you look closely, all the stuff that she's carrying, all the trash that she's carrying around on her back, you could see a chessboard and a few other things as well. And there's a Jareth kind of doll on her bedroom table.
Well, yeah, that's weird, isn't it? Oh, yeah, it is too. Wow, look at that. I didn't notice that before.
Yeah, this is kind of I could definitely... Oh, there's a Wizard of Oz book right there. I guess this is where the Wizard of Oz, influence is popping up, because if you know the Wizard of Oz, at least at the end of the story, but also the original film, it's left ambiguous whether Dorothy actually went to Oz or if it was all a dream. But even then, if it was all a dream, all the things that happened to all the characters she met and all the events that happened to her were inspired by things that happened in her own life. So it's possible that doll of Jareff, which I don't know if it was in her actual bedroom earlier in the film. Could have been what inspired the look of Jareff in these scenes. Like, because could as well.
Yeah.
Sarah, whatever.
Ludo. Ludo. Gotta love the Ludo.
And also there's a little bit of, like, again, with The Wizard of Oz, is that she teams up with three other characters as well. So you got Hoggle, Ludo, and the little dog creature whose name I keep forgetting as well. And they've gone to a city to open up a door, which is very Oz-like.
Mm.
So I wouldn't be surprised, like, yeah, I know, like, Jim Henson was very open about the influences, but this is definitely a very much a homage at the moment.
Definitely.
Mm. That guard is not doing his job.
Oh my god.
Sleeping on the job. I like how the sort of the dog, Ambrosius, keeps it goes back and forth between him being an actual real dog and also a puppet as well.
Yeah, yeah. And like you don't notice that as a kid. You really don't.
Oh no, no, definitely not. See, there are things in this movie I completely forgot. I forgot about this.
Like the big golem. How can you I mean, I've seen it a million times, but yeah, it's cool. The golem is cool with all the goblins inside of it and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just so much creativity in this film.
Oh, I agree. Very well done.
Oh, yeah. I think people kind of just very much don't give Jim Henson enough credit. Like, yes, he's the man behind the Muppets, and we always love him forever for that, because, you know, the Muppets are legendary.
Yeah.
But I think people kind of just underestimate him as a filmmaker and as a storyteller.
I don't know. Like I say, the reality of doing something new, like, this is the thing, like, even as an artist, like, being an artist painter, and then, like, you know, being a filmmaker too, like, what I struggle with, and I suppose something that really grinds my gears, we're talking about gears here because we've got that big golem with the gears or whatever, I think, is that, you know, you could come up with something really creative. And I find that some of the most original stuff never gets respect until it's later, too late in the picture.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, you look at some of the greatest writers and artists like H.P. Lovecraft, and, you know, there's just all these, you know, Van Gogh, you know, people don't realize the genius and the creativity till later. And it's the same with Henson. I think Henson, we're going to look at Henson in even 30 years' time and say he was a master craftsman, you know, master art director, movie maker, whatever, you know, puppeteer. And this is the thing, man, like, honestly, this is why being very creative can also suck, because you can be so creative that people don't understand it. Like, it's too new, it's too creative, because unfortunately the masses, like a lot of the masses want to see the same old crap. Unfortunately, this is why Hollywood goes back to old things. It doesn't want to take risks. But the reality is they can't take a risk because they're going to lose money as well. So it's, as an artist, and this is, I'm not having a whinge and, you know, saying I'm going to give up. But as an artist, you, even me as a painter, just painting pictures, I could paint you know, what everyone wants, which is a cute baby wolf painting, and it will sell like millions of copies. You know, a wolf pup painting. That's probably going to be my next hit painting, you know. But I could paint this most beautiful ancient scene of a great Greco-Roman temple with some philosophers in it and some sort of fantasy weird basilisk creature sitting in the corner. And it could be done so well and so creative and something really new about that painting. But people like, I don't get it because I don't know what that is. I don't understand what that is. You know what I mean? And that's what I think is really hard with people that are creative like myself and even, you know, geniuses like Henson. And I'm not comparing myself to them, but I'm saying these people that create these amazing works of art in film, and they do something original, and this is why he probably got so hurt about it not succeeding the way it did. I don't blame him, because the reality is the way the law that, you know, the universe kind of works in this, and the way the people, what people want and what an artist wants is very different. You know what I mean? What creative people want to create and express themselves with is very different to what the masses want to watch. You know, you can go, prime example is now you're looking at X-Men and Deadpool, right? There's been hints now, like on social media, of Deadpool with Wolverine and Wolverine wearing the traditional X-Men costume from the 90s comics. Because all the movies with X-Men, they look nothing like the actual comic book costumes, the costumes in the comics, you know? And like all the fan reactions, like really, really happy. The fans are happy. But film studios, when they made the X-Men movies and they made Wolverine, they were too scared to use these hyper-colored versions of Wolverine, you know, the yellow and blue traditional suit with the mask and everything like that. You know, and this is the thing that is, like when you're a creative, it can be depressing, you know, that you create something very original, what you think, it could be subjective, it could be something original, but people don't see that. They just say, they look and go, what is this, you know? And sometimes you might make something popular, and I won't talk about paintings of mine because I don't want to give away my secrets, but I'll create a painting and it'll be really popular. And I look back and I go, I know why that's popular. Even though it's an original painting, there's nothing stolen from fan art or any other IP, but it's borrowing things from Disney or it's borrowing ideas. It's not, you know what I mean? And you probably know what I'm talking about, Bede, but...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People want something familiar and it's adding that twist. And sometimes it's not so much fun as an artist. It's not that creative, you know? It's just being smart, being a business person. And that sucks, you know, that we don't really celebrate creativity and come up with new things, like, you know. So, but yeah, that's just my take. Well, I don't know. I don't know what you think of what I'm saying, you know, if I'm just rambling on here. But
well, I guess for me, it never really bothered me that, like, at least in the X-Men films, like the early ones, that the characters didn't wear their costumes from the comics.
Mm.
Like, it just never really bothered me because, you know, at the end of the day, a film and a comic are two separate things.
Yeah, I know. I don't think that's the point I'm talking about. I think the point is, like, I don't care about that either, but it's just more people don't want anything too creative on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what I'm trying to say. But also with art sometimes doing something too creative, you know, some people love it and they do look for that really weird, you know, like your Salvador Dali paintings. People want that really weird and warped thing. And then there's some people that don't, you know. But yeah, we are definitely living in a very weird age with this AI stuff. And I don't think it's really good for humanity. I think all these companies that are saving money or whatever, I think they're losing their soul. And I actually was starting a PhD on the Uncanny Valley. I was like talking about this, like, look at that goblin thing, that thing flying in the background. What the hell was that? What the hell was that? What the hell is that?
I don't know, but that's the great thing about like a film like this is the attention to detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, because not just like things that are happening in the foreground, there's other things that are happening in the background as well. like that little creature that just went flying in the, like, in the sky. Like, Jim Henson didn't have to put that there, but he did anyway, and we appreciate it. Yeah, exactly.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, this has so much soul. Each character, the puppets are controlled by humans. Most of these goblins are, you know, tiny people in suits, small people in suits. And it feels so real. And there's soul to the acting. There's soul to the puppeteering. There's artistry to it all. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, CG art, you don't get that. And Uncanny Valley, what I was talking about, what I was studying with my PhD, was that basically, you know, you're never going to capture the human soul in with computer graphics. You're never going to capture, like, you know, this is why we've got the most hyper-realistic environments. Like, you look at a Formula One game, video game, it looks like you're watching. I watch a Formula One video game, and I think I'm watching the proper Formula One on TV, right? Whereas as soon as you start putting humans into it, like with a face, a human face in there, we know straight away it's CG. And it's like they're getting closer and closer and making them look more realistic. Like you're looking at, I'm just trying to think of a movie, like Princess Leia, when she passed, when Carrie Fisher passed away and they had to put her in the new Star Wars movie, they used CG. Yeah. And same with that general in Star Wars, they use human CG, but you can still tell that was this uncanny, uneasy feeling. And that's what the Uncanny Valley is called. And you get that now with even AI art. You look at the humans and the faces and the arms, you get this really creepy feeling. You're looking and going, this isn't a real person, you know, because it isn't. It has, it's just pixels on a screen. It does not have a soul like an actor. And this is why this works, like Jim Henson works, is because it's the only way you can get away from the Uncanny Valley is by characterizing things, making things a caricature, you know? And like Hoggle's perfect example. Imagine Hoggle in CG, how bad it would look versus a puppet, you know what I mean, in that scene? But it's because it's a caricature. It's not, they're not trying to make it look like a real person that's that small, you know what I mean? They're not trying to make it look like a height challenged person.
Yeah,
you know, so the fact that they've done a caricatured puppet mask on top of an actor, you know, is why it was successful. So, but yeah, and this is the thing, like movies like this have so much soul. Because there is, it's the artist puts soul into things in making it come to life. You know, Jim Henson put soul into it. You know?
Oh, definitely. Oh, no, we're getting, she only has a few minutes to find her brother.
Uh-oh.
Oh, well, we're done. We've done our job. We're out of here. Fuck you, Sarah. Bye. That's what they would say in my version of the story.
Go fuck yourself, Sarah. Oh, God. I love this scene with the actual this is a homage to M.C. Escher.
You know. Yeah, like, I was going to say, like, the famous painting with the stairs. Like.
Yeah. He did a whole series of different types of things with stairs, so.
And of course, David Bowie's got to do one more song.
Well, David Bowie has to do the dance and whatever.
Oh, exactly.
You know, he has to prance around and tempt her with his bulge, enormous bulge, you know.
and also that hair.
Oh, yeah, that hair, man.
Hair like that could only exist in the 80s. Because it couldn't exist in any other time other than 1986. Because if it did, it would just look weird. And I mean, it works for David Bowie because, you know, it's David fucking Bowie. But here's a bit of an interesting bit of trivia I sort of read. Whenever you see David Bowie play with his balls, And I'm talking about the glass balls, not the if you look at the scene, that's not actually his hands rolling the balls around.
Mm.
Because they got somebody, I think a magician, who could do that. So whenever these scenes happen, he's actually crouching behind David Bowie and doing the tricks with his hands.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's so seamless. Like,
this set would have been really hard to do.
Oh yeah. And of course there would be a lot of optical effects in this as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Like, but camera angles, getting right, a lot of matte paintings, a lot of background paintings, a lot of walls painted.
I would be surprised if they kind of also used a rig to kind of turn the set upside down as well in certain shots.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Like, it's pretty impressive. I think out of all the scenes in this film, and there's a lot of great scenes in it, this is one that's definitely the most impressive into how they were able to achieve it.
Definitely, man. It's a magic to it, you know?
Hmm.
It's a dance magic, that's what it is.
It's a magic dance.
The magic dance. That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Oh God, I won't. I promise I won't start singing again.
If I push my little brother, then I can just blame it on Jareth.
Bean, see you in the NT, mate.
Hey, it's not my fault she hates her brother. I mean, she's the one who sent him there.
That's a good scene, too. That's a brilliant scene as well.
Mm. I should say it's her fault that he got kidnapped in the first place.
Yeah.
Geez, the cloak that Bowie is wearing right now, I can't tell where the hair ends and the hair begins.
Where? Yeah.
And also the bulge has now gotten even bigger. It's almost bigger as Bowie's head.
Yeah, I like this version of the Bowie there. Like, it looks cool, this costume. Like, it looks cool.
Mm.
Jareth, like, it's very kind of, very fancy, very lush. It's a very lush looking, you know?
Mm. And also another really cool thing about, I don't know if you know about this, but if you look at David Bowie's eyes, he actually has two different eye colors.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's got heterochromia.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing that's I've always found until I realize, oh, he's got two different colored eyes. It's like, why there's something odd, but you're not sure what it is. But when you know, it's like, oh, he's got two different eyes, it all makes sense.
Yeah. Definitely.
Here, touch my ball.
Oh my God.
You knew that was gonna come.
Oh my God, please.
Could have been worse. He could have had two balls in his hand.
Oh my God.
Oh, wait a minute, sorry.
Talking about your balls, Bede, please.
Sorry. We're talking about David Bowie's balls right about now.
Oh God.
Actually, he's not holding his balls. He's cupping his balls.
Oh, my God. Please, stop. Stop. Please. Move
balls.
On.
Balls. All right, I'm done.
Gross. Please.
It's 13 o'clock.
Oh, my God. Time to show off my balls now.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
I don't know what's hair or what's clothes of David Bowie's.
Oh my God.
And now he's an owl. And now she... Oh, I'm back in the real world. I hope Toby's here so I can send him back to the Goblin Realm again.
Oh, God. Are we coming to the end of it? Wow, we are.
Ah, leave me alone, sister. I'm trying to sleep.
Yeah. You sold me out.
I'll remember this.
Oh, God.
I like how basically, like, you think, okay, is this going to go similar to, like, The Wizard of Oz, where it's going to be a little ambiguous as well, whether she went to the labyrinth or not. But I'm but it ends like, no, she actually went to the labyrinth.
Mm.
And all of her friends come to visit. Oh, if only Sting was in this movie.
You reckon?
Oh, so there is a Jareth doll
in
her real world of her room.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's just,
I know, and I've never noticed it before. That is weird.
I wonder what the, like, why would they do that? Like, it's weird.
Again, maybe it's the whole Wizard of Oz thing. Like, whether it is actually...
Oh, Ludo in the mirror. Oh. I like, actually has a good, like, good
look,
vibe.
And even that painting we just talked about before with the stairs, that's there on her wall as well.
Yeah, I know. All those little details are crazy.
Again, I think this is definitely a Wizard of Oz kind of reference with, again, it all makes sense now. And also, the dog, like, what is on the, is in that photo right there.
Yeah, it's a happy ending. It's kind of a sad, bittersweet. There's a cat's poster there. Look at that.
Yeah, I know.
Homage to the 80s.
Oh, no, they're all real. Let's have a party.
Yeah, it's a good ending. It's has a good vibe. It's good, got a good vibe to it, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
Yeah, it was a very well done movie, but, you know, what can you do?
Well, that's the thing, though.
Sometimes, like I said, very original stuff or really something very different, you know, people don't appreciate, you know, and that's just the reality of it. And that's something that I've got to come to grips with too as an artist, you know, that's you make something and if people don't like it, it's just because people only go for stuff that they know or looks like it reminds them of something, you know what I mean, that they're comfortable with or that they like already, or it's a theme that is well known, you know, something very too. And it's the thing with trying to sell paintings and be creative or sell a movie, whatever you're doing, sometimes something that's very different and original isn't really liked, you know, unless it becomes well known or it hits people's faces a few times, you know. Hack my home. Is that what you're trying to do? You're trying to hack my home, are you?
I am not trying to hack your home. But, well, I know what you mean, but I think at the end of the day, because, yeah, this movie, even though this film ended up being a flop when it was released, but it became a cult classic years later because, like, once it came out on video,
people
rented it out at the video shop, rented it for their kids, and then it just sort of grew an audience.
I wonder how much more money it would have made on VHS, like would have made more.
I would say it probably would have made a lot more, I would reckon.
Yeah, so do you judge, like, okay, it made $35 million at the box office, but how many more would have made another $100 million on VHS or with
the I'm sales, not exactly sure.
All the merch, you know what I mean? I wonder if he saw that later. And he reaped the rewards of it. You know what I mean? Like the merch.
Well, I don't know because, like, we got to remember, like, David Bowie, I mean, not David Bowie, Jim Henson died 4 years after this movie. So it probably would have taken he probably didn't live long enough to see this film become a cult classic, which is kind of a sad thing. But we're going to end this on a happy note because we're not going to end it on a sad note.
Let's get off the sad topics, my God.
exactly. But, I guess that will stop the movie right there.
Yeah.
so that was our audio commentary of Labyrinth. And I hope all of our audience enjoyed listening to this episode. And Anthony, thank you so much for coming on and watching and discussing this film with me.
No, thank you. It was great. I mean, this is a cult classic. It's always good talking with you, Bede. And, you know, thanks for having me on. And hopefully, you know, I inspire people to be an artist and follow their dreams. And yeah, if, you know, feel free to check out my project. And, yeah, you can read some of my comics for free. I think we've got 3 issues for free at luminousages.com. Mm-hmm. And this spin-off comic is part of, it's a spin-off, but it's the 4th book in the series, and it is part of the whole universe anyway. So, you know, you find out about the next god, and it helps tie in the next big graphic novel I have planned, which I don't know when that will come out, but, you know, we've got it written, and it takes a while to paint comics, as you know, and create these things. So, but as I was saying, thanks for having me on, man. It was really good.
Yeah, no worries, man. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed yourself, and, I guess we can wrap up the episode right now. But before we do, Anthony, where can people find you on the internet this week? And also, where can people find your work and also the Kickstarter?
Yeah, so if you go to Kickstarter, you just type in Goblin Origins, I think it is, or Goblin Dice. That should come up. Like, it's called Gobaloi Goblin Origins, right? So if you just type in Goblin Dice, it should come up as one of the Kickstarters. Yeah, it's called Gobaloi Goblin Origins Fantasy Comic, the Metal Goblin Dice. I have a website for my art and my books and everything, and my dice, everything. It's at achristouart.com, so achristouart.com. Not only do I do obviously my own comics and fantasy art, but I have other pop culture artworks from Alice in Wonderland, you know, right through to other cool stuff like dragons and pirate ships and whatever you're into, really, a whole range of sci-fi stuff as well. So, yeah.
Awesome. And if people want to find all things the Super Network, you can find us at our official website at supermarcy.com. And also you can find us at Twitter at twitter.com/SM_Supernetwork. And also the official Facebook page at facebook.com/TheSuperNetwork. And also you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/TheSuperNetwork. And as low as $1 a month, you can get some really awesome bonus content, including early access to all of our episodes before they drop online. And as well as you can find our podcast on all podcast streaming services everywhere. And if people want to find me personally, you can find me on my official Twitter page at twitter.com/BeJamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BeJamine. And once again, you can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And also you can follow my solo podcast, Bead vs. the Living Dead, on all podcast streaming services everywhere. And follow the official Twitter account of that at twitter.com/BeedVSTLD. So yeah, that's the end for this episode of the Super Podcast. We hope you all enjoyed this one, and we'll see you next time, everybody. See everybody. Bye.
Bye.
TriStar Pictures announces the collaboration of 3 extraordinary talents. Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets and Dark Crystal. George Lucas, creator of the Star Wars saga. And one of the most innovative forces in modern entertainment, David Bowie. Together, they will take you into a dazzling world of fantasy and adventure.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
A world where anything seems possible, and nothing is what it seems.
Everything I've done for you. I move the stars for no one.
Run so far.
Goblin.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy Shark doo 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 doo. Surfy Shark doo 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 doo.
And now back to the show.